The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Happy Thursday. This is episode 129 of the Two Shot Podcast. It's only with Samantha Morton. Yeah, I know. Right, a few thank yous. Don't worry, they're all for you. Yes, you. What an overwhelming reaction we had to episode 128 comeback last week with Lenny James. As you all know, it was such a mammoth episode. We split it into two parts. If you haven't listened to part two, make sure you sign off on that, because some people are saying it's their favourite episode so far. But I love Lenny so much and I love chatting to him. And as with last week, what you'll get with this week is I think you'll get a real sense of who Sam Morton is and where she's from and her beliefs. It's an amazing natter. It really is great. I'm so chuffed she finally came on, because as you can hear at the start, we've been talking about this for ages, which always happens. But with the current state of the world, people seem to have a little bit more time on their hands. So a massive thank you to you all for your messages on social media and your emails. I'm so pleased that you enjoyed it as much as you did. Another thank you to all the people on our social media feed who took the merch poll. It seems bags, mugs, and tote bags, mugs, badges seem to be coming out on top. So we are looking into that, and it's a way for us to say thank you to you and for you to support us about what we do. For those that do follow us on our social media feed, you may have seen maybe a week or so ago, I think just before Lenny, before we announced that we were coming back, I did say that things might not get back to normal straight away. It might be a slightly slow, if not steady, return. I'm going to try and keep it going, but there's a few things that I have to do in the coming weeks which may affect the rollout of episodes. There'll be a slight little bump in the road, possibly. I'm just giving you a heads up, but obviously I'll let you know as and when. But don't worry, it ain't going to be any sort of long break like what we have had. It may be a week, it may be two. I can't envisage it being any longer than that. That's all. Well, it's episode 129 of the Two Shot Podcast. This is Samantha Morton. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
But there are also knobs out there, let's face it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's people like that. But if you give people the knowledge, and as you say, sort of not scaremongering,
yeah,
it's going to be easier for everybody.
Exactly.
But Sam, how are you?
I'm okay. I've been better. It's hard because I'm talking to you and you're my friend. So it's like I've got to remember this is like business.
Yeah. Well, it's not business. It's just two friends having a conversation.
Okay. I'm okay. I didn't do well with lockdown at all.
In what way?
First of all, I was shielding. I've got asthma and I've had pneumonia a few times and pleurisy and things like that. So I've got, you know, from, I think it's also growing up with chain smoking parents back in the 80s. Do you know what I mean? And I've never smoked myself in that because I just can't bloody breathe. But, and so I think initially, because we'd been in America for so long, when we got home, we were so excited to be home back in the UK and see friends and family. And we all got a nasty winter bug anyway, regardless of the virus. And then literally just as our lives were kind of, we're back home, we've been away for a long time, you know, planning on seeing everybody, this kicked off. And I remember thinking before, you know, way, way early on that something wasn't right. And I said to Harry, my husband, I said really early, do you know my husband? Very early on, I said, I think this is the biggie. And I think that, you know, we need to be extra careful. And our house was on the market. So we were having people in and out there, like viewers, second viewings, third viewings and surveyors and everything. And like a nutter, my very, very sweet estate agent thought I was absolutely nuts, but I was making everybody wear booties, masks and gloves. This is before it...
Were you really?
Yeah, even before it was a thing. When I was reading about it in China, I just had a sense that it was something was dodge.
It's on its way.
Just dodge. Like, hold on a minute, this is it. We were due one anyway, do you know what I mean? And there's been... They all thought I was nuts, but my estate agent was like, oh, you're ahead of the curve, you're ahead of the curve, whatever, when it all kicked off. And he... Yeah, but it was just that, first of all, was really tricky. And then we bought this house. I bought a house off on the internet. Or not off the internet, but I bought a house that I saw on the internet. I mean, like an absolute just idiot. A dream house,
great,
obviously.
Great time, yeah.
And then that kind of went through just before lockdown, so I couldn't go to my new house. And the government was like, you can't move now. And so we'd bought one house, was selling another. And so we were kind of, it was really odd, and I had all this work coming in. And then that work just overnight just disappeared.
Yeah.
Which is what it is. But when you're kind of going, you've your whole life has to shift, you know what I mean, immediately with navigating a global pandemic and your health and the health of your children and the welfare of your children. And do you know what I mean? So it was just a bit tricky. And so, yeah, we got into our new house about 8 weeks ago. Our dream new house, and it's absolutely magical. So I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm just surrounded by so many boxes, because that was the other thing. The house is, I mean, absolute perfection in the fact that I love it, but it's not been done, touched since the 60s.
Right.
A lot of which we're keeping because we love this, I love a lot of the, you know, how it looks and everything. But it still is really, like, needs new wiring and plumbing, and it's just tired. And initially, you know, you couldn't have anyone in the house to do that. We weren't allowed anyone in this property to do that because of, you know, lockdown. And now, so we're living in the house going, how are we going to manage this? I bought a caravan, so I think we're going to live in the caravan.
It's a great caravan. I mean, they can't even call it a caravan. It's a bloody Airstreamer.
It is a very...
It's so beautiful.
It is a very nice caravan. But we're a big family. And I listen, you know, I've only been, you know, kind of here for a few weeks and I was like, hold on a minute. How we've got through lockdown without killing each other. We've got, you know, living in a caravan. Whenever Success. You watch Grand Designs and you see these families, you're like, oh, my God.
I could never do that.
And exactly. You're like, oh. And they've, you know, and they, you know, he sits there and he's like, and what's your budget and all this? And you're like, fucking hell, fire. You know, like, it all seems a bit excessive. But we're not doing a big Grand Designs thing. We're just putting new pipes in. And some new taps.
Essential things,
yeah, because I love the house. I mean, all the things as well, I thought I'd change, like, or need a new kitchen because this kitchen was put in 1964. I've grown to absolutely love it. Like, just being here a few weeks, it's an old, like, just wooden, you know, kitchen they had made. It's just sweet and wood and it's quite Japanese in a way because obviously it's just beautiful. And then also, like, the bathroom is proper blue, like everything's blue. and Harry can't even look at it without feeling a bit ill. And I was like, right, that's got to go. And, you know, thinking about new bathrooms. And then now I love it. I just want some new taps. Blue bath. Going to get rid of the bidet, though. I don't think that's very... We don't really need a bidet.
No. Because we'd had quite a long break from recording episodes. Since May, I haven't really recorded any apart from Lenny last week.
Yeah.
And prior to that, the early ones in May, during the lockdown, I wasn't really discussing the lockdown because it was quite, it was only a couple of months in and it was kind of new. And I wanted the episodes to kind of have a history and survive and not be tagged into the pandemic. But it's gone on so long now and people have, because a comedian friend of mine, Matt Ford, didn't leave his two-bedroom flat because he's got severe asthma and didn't see anybody.
Yeah, that must have been really awful for him.
Well, it was really awful for him, but, you know, people always have these quite extravagant plans about what they're going to do and what they're going to learn. He ended up writing a book.
That's phenomenal.
which is incredible. And that wouldn't have happened without that.
Oh, that's amazing. I think...
Yeah.
I used to look at people on Instagram, just briefly, in between everything else that was happening and see these incredible families doing these incredible things or, you know, people put what they want to put on Instagram though, don't they? They put the kind of the life they want to, you know, it's like makeup, people putting makeup on before they leave the house or a certain image or whatever. Well,
they put on the life that they want you to see.
Yeah. I mean, for me, we were struggling because I think moving house is tough at any time, isn't it? Packing up a house.
Yeah,
and our house in Derbyshire, a big old manor house, and it was absolutely, you know, we'd filled it with all our life. And then we had obviously the barn with the recording studio and the, you know, we just had a lot of stuff to pack up. And so the kids, bless them, obviously you're doing BBC Bite Size with Teddy, he's little, and you're trying to make sure he's okay. You know, Edie's doing school online or whatever, and I found that literally there was no time to do anything because you get up in the morning, it's not just breakfast, kids go to school, and your routine of laundry or housework. It was like there was more of everything to do,
yeah,
and trying to make sure that they were okay. Certainly Teddy, who's 6 years old, to not see any other child other than his sister, who's at that age where she doesn't want to play with a six-year-old boy. I mean, she's lovely. She's a great big sister. But, you know, there's only so much play she can do because she's past that age in some ways, or developmentally. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there was the beautiful aspect of us spending so much time together, which I hear from a lot of people as well. That's beautiful. But we're a very tight-knit family anyway because we're on the road together all the time.
Yeah.
And the kids are sometimes homeschooled. And so we have that thing going on. But I think there was also kind of the general sense of what does this mean in regards to even food. So for us, Harry's mum came to stay with us because she'd been stuck in Nepal. So she got out just before the borders closed and she came to stay with us because she's over 70. And she was in the, she quarantined in the barn where the recording studio was. And we were like, oh, great, we'll hopefully get some shopping then, because she's, you know, you get a letter, you got a shield or whatever. Mm. But no, we couldn't get any deliveries. It was really, 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 yeah, we could, where we lived in Derbyshire, we were really struggling.
Because it was too remote?
Yeah, but nobody, just nobody would deliver to us. We couldn't get a slot, we couldn't get any local organic delivery company. You know what I mean? Veg box vibe. When you live rurally, it is really different, especially in somewhere like, it's not like Second Homesville where we lived. It was just a very ordinary, fantastic working, you know, farming community. And because we're vegan, it's not like we can nip over to another farmer and go, oh, have you got any lamb or chickens or a bit of beef or, you know, local dairy products that you can get from the farm shops. But then you're also being told to stay in your house. You're not allowed out.
No. Well, my dad was shielding as well.
Oh,
and
good.
Early on in the lockdown, there was one time that they couldn't get a slot or anything. So I just did a big shop for them and just drove back to Blackpool.
Right,
and
you're
just
dropped amazing. It off. At
the,
you're amazing.
Just dropped it off at the door.
Well, what I did, because I'm, you know, I know how to cook or whatever, we had a lot of, and also because we live where we live and we have a lot of snowstorms where we get snowed in for days, I did have a big pantry with, I've got a big pantry, with a lot of dry goods. I've always got the what if cupboard as well. I've always had a what if cupboard that has literally what if anything happens. So we were fine for a lot of dried goods, which, you know, lots of people couldn't get hold of, you know, flour, because we make our own bread anyway. Do you know what I mean? We're kind of a foodie type family. And I think when you're vegan as well, or, you know, I say mostly vegan, you have to, within the family, you really, really have to know how to cook. You have to know how to make all sorts when you're vegan. Otherwise, you're not going to get a balanced diet. Mm. So that was okay. But then eventually we got some, you know, we found someone who would deliver some to somewhere in Matlock to a special location, and we'd sneakily drive to Matlock and pick this box of veg up, because otherwise we'd have been apt. I was growing stuff, but it, you know, it's seasonal, isn't it? You're like, come on.
Exactly.
You know, I haven't got any kale yet or any potatoes yet, you know what I mean? But we were growing from seed. And so I think in regards to a pandemic, watching how every different country's handled it as well, and watching our government, I mean, horrifically make mistakes, and that has, I believe, you know, cost lives. There's also, you know, a sense of getting a bit agoraphobic, weirdly. It's a bit like that condition where people fall in love with their kidnappers. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Initially, you're really like claustrophobic. You know, you can't bear it. You want to get out. You want to do things. You feel restricted. And then all of a sudden that becomes really safe and you're afraid to go out.
Exactly. And but it's the enforced nature of it. It's like you're being told that you can't do anything. And and I've always been someone who's been thought, no, I'm really good with my own company. But when it's enforced and you can't do anything and you can't see anybody, that changes things. It turns it on its head.
And you also, with you know, you're a dad, so you'll get this. We don't really like the kids watching too much telly or too much screen time. We like to do things as a family, and whether it's having a game of Sorry or game of cards or walking, or, you know, routines like we watch once a week, we'll watch a documentary together, or, you know, Teddy loves his, you know, his Attenboroughs. Do you know what I mean? All of that. But then all of a sudden we find ourselves with going, right, well, we can't drive, you know, you can't go anywhere outside your community. You know, you can have one walk outside a day. Now, we were lucky because we've got, because we lived on a farm, we've got, you know, you saw in a couple of fields. We were a small farm, but we just got puppies before lockdown as well. Like, we didn't know this was going to happen. Oh my gosh. So, and it just felt really very, very sad. Really sad.
Yeah.
And then I'd watch videos of everyone clapping for the NHS and thinking, obviously, our village was clapping, but it wasn't the same as being in a city and...
You're on a street.
Yeah, when you're like, oh, my God.
One, the community all comes together. Yeah.
But it is what it is. And I think that now it's navigating, again, having, and I'm not somebody that doesn't trust governments. I'm not one of those people and all that. I think they've got a really tough job, whether it's, you know, Conservative or Labour. I do not envy anybody in that position having to make the right decisions based on economy, health, all the rest of it. It's not easy. And I think, you know, hats off to, you know, the Chancellor for some of the things he did at the time and immediately. Could have done more, but then they're going to be criticised, you know, either way.
Yeah.
But I do think in regards to the common sense aspect of it, when you look at New Zealand, you're like, hold on a minute, they seem to be getting this a bit right. And why aren't they mass testing everybody? Why is everybody suffering at home? Hold on a minute, you've got a deadly virus, but we're not going to help you. You've got to deal with this at home on your own. And so now, kids going back to school in a few weeks, I'm really, really worried because I read the, yeah. you know, I read all different kinds of news and I like to just keep abreast of it all, whether it's the New York Times, looking at the Daily Mail, you know, the BBC, the Guardian, you know, just across the board looking at it all. And I think that the overwhelming evidence is that children do spread it. They don't seem to suffer as much, but they do suffer, can die. Mm. And that they've had cases, certainly in Georgia, where one child has infected, has been a super spreader and has infected, you know, whole communities. You know, schools have had to close down. And that, you know, and we're talking hundreds of people getting coronavirus. Mm. So it's, is that going to happen here, even though our numbers are low, even though they're doing these little bubbles or whatever? I feel just very, you know, if the whole country was being tested every week, like little kits arriving and you have to send it off.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't know. It just, so I'm a bit, sorry to ramble. I'm a bit
Look.
Confused and concerned and, a bit,
I think we're all confused and nervous,
yeah.
certainly about the children going back. I mean, certainly they can't go back to have any sort of normality or the way it was. They can't just throw them all into schools for the sake of the economy. And
for their mental health, they're saying their well-being. But do you know what?
Well,
what they're talking about well-being, the government is saying, we have no choice on this. So in the same way as an actor, if you take your kid out of local school, you either lose their place or you're fined. You know, you're penalised whether you're a musician or you're an actor or, you know, you're a roadie or anything to do with the arts and travel. You don't get any support from your school or the local authority because they literally blanket everybody with, if your kid's not in school, you're going to get fined or sent, you know, or prosecuted. Do you know what I mean? That vibe.
Mm.
It's just awful. And the same with this. Even if you're, like, for me, my doctor, when it kicked off the first time, because there'd been a case in Buxton and my son's school shared a teacher, a PE teacher, with the school that one of the first cases of coronavirus was at.
Yeah.
And I had a chat with my doctor and we agreed that because of my susceptibility and my low immune system, whatever, that we'd take the kids out of school immediately before, you know, and then I had to get letters and then I had to, you know, compromise my own immunity by taking that letter into school and, you know, it was just, and now they're saying it doesn't matter. Even if you're somebody that's shielded, your kids have to go to school. You know, you don't have the choice.
It's a fucking minefield, to be honest, because I'm really confused too and very nervous.
I mean, don't get me wrong, my kids are desperate to get back to school. They need it more than they need their peers more than anything.
I think all children yeah. are desperate.
But if it's the sake of another 6 months not being in a classroom environment where we've got a vaccine or the numbers are ridiculously low globally, because we're only as strong as our weakest link. And if our borders are open to all, I mean, I've got mates that have just got back from America or Spain, literally the last week, nobody's really checking on them, quarantining. It's a bloody joke.
No, they're walking, they're going, where are you staying? All right, off you pop.
Yeah, what's
that? Nice one, border control. Brilliant.
It's like an episode, it's like though. A comedy show. It's not funny, it's really scary.
No, it's really fucking scary. For a podcast that said that we don't really yak on about lockdown and stuff like that, we've done a pretty good job to start
we did.
The podcast off with you, didn't go. We? But I think it's really important because I was saying to somebody the other day, I've only just been able to concentrate on watching a film or watching a documentary. There was a time where I just said it to a friend last night, I couldn't listen to music because it sort of evoked too much emotion.
Yeah,
it's been a big roller coaster of emotion.
For you as well, get this.
For me as well, yeah. And also, I remember going, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to finish reading this, and I would reread the same page. It just wasn't going in. Yeah. The words, they didn't mean anything. It's like when you repeat a word over and over again till it becomes meaningless.
Yeah, or even looking at it, the word the, what the fuck is that all about?
Yeah,
the,
and then
the,
it just, yeah, it doesn't, yeah. So that was like the start for me. Did you have anything like that, or were you quite productive?
Yeah, no. I mean, obviously looking after the kids, and Harry was busy packing up the house as best he could, and we both were, but he was doing most of the work while I was with the children. But you've also got, like, I've only just watched the Tiger thing on Netflix. I mean, talk about late to the party.
I haven't even gone there.
Because the only thing that I was able to watch the whole of lockdown was MasterChef. Because I love MasterChef anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I do love it anyway, but it was this thing of you're not even really watching, if that makes sense, because it's just you can dip in and out of it. It's, you know. And I had this idea because I write diaries. I have done since I was a very, very little girl, and I've always kept a diary, and it, you know, right away. And I'm writing, and I started at the beginning of lockdown, really, you know, writing about the experience and how it was affecting me. And then I couldn't. I literally would get into bed, well, crash, you know, at the end of the day, shattered, like on my knees, go, right, I've got to sleep now, my wide awake. But I couldn't write. It was almost, you know, I couldn't even, it was weird. The thing that was the nicest thing for me was the Jarvis Cocker's parties on Instagram. He did these, you know, and I went to a couple of those and met some nice people, had a couple of Bacardi and Cokes or whatever, and and had a dance around my handbag, and that was really fun. But other than that, I was a bit like you, actually. And we, it's funny that, isn't it? And I think it's because on a, you know, subconscious level, I was doing quite a bit of exercise, trying to keep the kids fit, because other than doing the schoolwork, you know, I tried the Joe Wicks one morning with the kids, and that was just daft. We were bopping each other in the faces in the front room, and I was like, oh, forget this. You know what I mean? So I just took them outside. We just went outside. I know enough about fitness to go, right, we're going to play Dobby Little Men. And then, or tag, if you don't know what Dobby Little Men is. And then football, netball. We had a netball. We got a basketball hoop, so that was there when we moved in. So we did a bit of that. Skipping. And just having a laugh outside and the best we could with the puppies, you know, because, I mean, I think the Joe Wicks thing was great for some people, but for us, it, you know, we were lucky enough to have a garden, so big garden, so we were doing that.
We ended up climbing trees.
Oh,
like
that's
every
cool.
other day.
Because
we just thought, right, well, if we start climbing trees, it's good and it's fun and it's exercise. And also, we're away from everybody else because we're
that's
up a bloody
amazing.
Tree.
That's amazing. We're bloody
so it's
and
the
fall
perfect.
Out.
No. We're quite
good. You're Spider-Man.
Yeah, we are.
Little spidey senses.
See, it's funny then because you were talking about sort of where you are now and you're in this house. And it's a far cry from where you started out, like growing up in Nottingham.
Yeah.
So I thought we'd sort of go back there and discuss growing up in Notts, which holds a very dear place in my heart, as you know, because, you know, you're from there and Vicky's from there and me and you filmed there for quite an intense period of time. And I really love the people. I've always... But what was it like when you were growing up? Because it's changed a lot, I think, over the years.
We've got trams. That's
I know.
We've got trams. What was it like for me growing up? We always have rose-tinted spectacles in some ways, don't we, when we want to. And I think for me, the older I get, the more those years are rosy. They're special, and they're kind of in a, almost in a, you know, those little snow globes that you can shake. Like my childhood is inside a snow globe, and it's really cool. And I could pick it up and go, oh, look at that. There's St. Anne's, and oh, there's Clifton, and there's, and all these different, because I was, as you know, I was in care. So I had lots of different lives, lots of different families, lots of different brothers and sisters and mums and dads and different realities as I kept moving around. And always in Nottingham. Luckily for me, back then, I wasn't moved out of Nottingham. So I knew the city like the back of my hand. I still do. You could drop me anywhere and I could walk, find my way back into town, to anywhere, just know it, just insanely well. And yeah, things do change when you go back and you drive back. Things don't look the same. Buildings are gone, sadly. You know, car parks are gone up or whatever. But I think the people in some ways stay the same. In obviously, we times change, social attitudes change. But there's something in the Nottinghamism of Nottingham that means there's a very, like, don't take yourself too seriously, funny, warm, kind.
Proud.
Yeah, very proud.
Because of you and Vicky, who I know, Sat Baines, who's a great chef, very proud of Nottingham and where they're from and their roots.
It's very interesting you say that because you don't know it because you're just from, but I've found myself, I mean, Harry has this joke where nothing's ever good enough because it's not from Nottingham or I'm not in Nottingham. So every, you know, we'll see a house, I'll be like, oh, it's not as nice as the ones in the park. And I'll be like, and talking about Fothergills and, you know, architects and you know, that's, and it's a bit like Naples, you know, because it's all built on sandstone and, you know, everything is better in Nottingham. And I think that there is a kind of a badge of pride, whether it's growing up. See, growing up in the 80s, you know, our Nottingham Forest were just doing incredibly well football wise. You've got, you know, Brian Clough that we all adored, and Nottingham's so small as well in a way that you would see the, you know, the footballers running along the Trent, you know, doing their training. Right. And these were, it was very, I don't know, I grew up with, you know, my grandma was Irish and my granddad's Polish, and I didn't sadly know my dad's dad, and my nonna, as we say, she was, I didn't really know her very well.
And also, it's a place, and this is from an outsider's perspective, that understands its identity. You know, when cities have an identity, I've always thought that of Nottingham. The very first time that I worked there, which was, again with you, which was like 11 years ago, I think. Fuck.
Yeah, control. It was control, yeah.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Yeah. Can we talk about going into care, Sam?
Yeah, we can. But just going back to the pride thing, it does punch above its weight as well because it's a very small city, but the Industrial Revolution did it a lot of favours. We had a huge, because we were central to so much stuff. Do you know what I mean? That's why it's called central, you know, the Midlands. And I believe I often refer to myself as a northerner, and Harry's like, you're not a northerner, you're from Nottingham, you're from the Midlands. I'm like, all right then. But when you live in London, anything north of the Watford Gap is bloody north, do you know what I mean?
So yeah, of course.
That's how it felt. But I think there is, for me growing up there, you've got, you know, Queen's Medical Centre, you've got your, which is a huge hospital there, but it's a teaching hospital. You've got all of these universities and colleges, some of the best, you know, in the world, Nottingham University. People coming from all over the world to study there. And you've got, I mean, you know, I used to go raving at the Marcus Garvey Centre, and that's who I learnt about, kind of Marcus Garvey, Martin Luther King. You know, Nottingham is incredibly multicultural as well. So you grow up, you just can't grow up, right? For me, I didn't know any racist people growing up, honestly, because at that point, there's just everybody's intermingled. So in Hyson Green, where I went to school, where I went to junior school, just everybody's from everywhere. And there was no...
And it was immediately accepted because it was just the norm.
Well, yeah, because Hyce and Green was a predominantly Pakistani community because obviously back in the day, the councils are doing segregation in a way because you've got you've got St. Anne's where, you know, kind of, I suppose they were placing the Windrush generation, do you know what I mean? Things like that. And then for whatever reason, when I was small, there's a big block of flats where there's an Asda there now, but that was massively Pakistani. And it's a little bit like when I lived in East London I lived in a Bengali community there. It's wonderful. It's life. It's like, so you don't, everybody and kids don't know race. They just want to play, the language of play. And I was jealous of all my friends who had saris because they looked fucking beautiful. And I wanted a bindi and I wanted henna on my hands and I wanted to celebrate Eid and I wanted to, you know, eat the sweets because the sweets were insane. That's all children know. And I think that that's why I love the city I'm from and I'm proud to be from there. And, you know, I'm sad I can't live there. I'm sad I don't live there. And breaks my heart a little bit. But I think that gave me going off into the world, like moving to New York at 19. Where are you from? From Nottingham. I didn't say I'm from England. I wouldn't say I'm from the UK, you know, Great Britain. I'm from, where are you from? Nottingham. What the fuck's that?
That's the thing that I'm talking about the pride that I think people from Nottingham exude. Yeah. They really do.
Yeah. Anyway, you can go on about the care thing now if you want.
I'm not going to go on about the care thing. I just want to delve a little deeper.
Yeah.
What age were you when you first went into care?
It's a baby. It's a little baby. And that was, I was in and out of care till I think I was about, and it's quite odd with dates and things and anyone listening, if they know any different, just let me know because it's all trying to piece together your life is really complex when your life is so hectic as a child and you feel like you've lived 10 lives before you're even 12. But yeah, I was in and out of care till I was about 7 and I think then I had kind of more longer term foster placements and as opposed to emergency fostering constantly. And then in 1989, I became, the Children's Act made me become basically a ward of court. So I then was owned by the state from that point onwards.
Yeah. Did it feel quite, did you feel as a child that it was disruptive for you that you were moving place to place, even though you were work within Nottingham?
I didn't identify with that. I didn't know the language of that until I was about 12 when I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, not again.
Right.
I mean, really, not again, when I got moved again and again and again. And because I was really settled at school, I was doing well at school, I got some really nice friends. And then I moved into... And to be fair, that when you're little and you get moved, you don't fully understand why. You're very sad, you're very frightened, you're very alone for a bit, and then you just get used to your new family. But then when you start having your own identity, when you've gone from Care Bears into Madonna, got to remember it is the 80s, you're suddenly feeling like a grown-up, even though you're not. You're not allowed to stay with a foster family for something very bizarre. My foster parents had separated, and I think the social services felt that my then foster mum, who sadly passed away from cancer when I was young, she wasn't able to be a single foster mum because that wasn't okay then.
Is that okay now?
You can be a foster carer and be single now. And I was not happy about that at all. And then started running away from various abusive foster homes. So I really started sleeping on the streets and we call it sofa surfing now, but then it was like just sneaking into mates' bedrooms and saying, can I kip in your bottom of your wardrobe tonight? Or that was from, the age of 12, 11, 12.
Till about when?
Oh, that didn't stop till I got my first... I think my first proper place was a homeless hostel on Mansfield Road in Nottingham. So I was 16.
How was all that affecting you, though, and sort of your mental health? Because there's no, you haven't put any, you can't put any roots down anywhere. So did that affect your identity of who you were?
I don't think we put a lot of emphasis on identity now in society. Young people, whether it's their sexuality, you know, there's a lot of identity conversation. You know, it's great you're asking this question, but we didn't really think about identity then. You're just living your life. You're just being. You know, and I got into the rave culture very young. I lied about my age a lot. I said I was 14 when I was 12. And even really, 14 was quite young to be doing what I was doing. I remember there was this whole thing about Amanda de Cadenet being the wild child on The Word and all that. And as I got out with some people and we'd just come back from Venus, and I really shouldn't have been in Venus at all. This was this night.
Who should? It sounds awful.
Oh, my, no, it was amazing.
Was it?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it was a club in Nottingham that was... Yeah, this guy James Bailey ran, and you got Sasha start, you know, did there, and just it was, and I could think of, you know, so many DJs that DJed there, but it was just proper incredible music and dancing, and I didn't like alcohol, I didn't drink, and I couldn't afford drugs, so I just liked dancing and being a little. At that point, I couldn't really afford drugs, but yeah, I remember we're going back to someone's. You always go back to someone's, don't you, when it shuts? Back at someone's and then someone going, oh. Because I looked older, I went vintage clothes shopping. I had this kind of amazing suit, like something from Sly and the Family Stone, this kind of flares. And I always been these mega platforms and this little jacket. And well, it's a suit. And everyone talked, you know, like saying that, you know, the idea of a wild child, but and Amanda de Cadenet, and thinking, fucking hell, you know, you want to come to Nottingham and see some of the people I hang out with, do you know what I mean? That'll fucking make your hair go curly.
Blow your socks off.
Yeah. So it was, I had a lot of fun. I had so much fun. I had adventures. I met amazing people from all walks of life through that rave community, through the DIY community as well, and the travellers, and, you know, sometimes hooking up with those people and going to amazing raves in the countryside and learning about, because I'd run away from school at that point, so like I never went back. And so my education was from a bunch of hippies, really. You know, whether it was learning about Nostradamus or, you know, kind of, you know, the artists or politics or magic mushrooms or, you know, eating vegan food. I mean, veganism, what the fuck, you know, back in 1991, being a vegetarian was fucking a bit brown.
Far out.
Yeah, sandals and brown cardigan, do you know what I mean? Or whatever the phrase was. It was, learning about all these things, and I loved it. I had a great time.
It's interesting because just a while back you were saying that you were doing really well at school and you were settled, and then obviously you ran away from school. So when did that start to decline?
I ran away from school because a couple of reasons. I was getting into a lot of trouble at school, and I think in hindsight I wasn't very pleasant. I used to... I got a job as a dancer, dancing at these raves on a podium. Not like what you see in Ibiza, all sexy or anything like that. It was literally just cycle top, a whistle, just getting everyone going, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The Garvey would close. All-nighters then were quite... They did happen, but they were more like till 3 a.m, whereas there was the club, Venus, the club. Like the thing is, you had your townies and your ravers. It was so funny looking back. And then you got your rockabillies and all these different groups in Market Square hanging out. And I liked everybody. I got on with everybody, loved everybody. And so I think for me, when I kind of being at those raves or whatever, and then going back to the children's home, because at this point I wasn't in foster homes anymore. I was in a really, really, really rough children's home, like proper... rough. And I was not happy there. And so, you know, and also it was like 2 buses to get to school. And then I had a voluntary driver because my children's home was in Bestwood, like Top Valley, Bestwood Park way.
Right.
And my school was in West Bridgeford, which was a really kind of a different kind of area. You know, the houses on the street where my school is are like 1.7 million today. You know, it's like very, very but it's a state school, but we don't, do you know what I mean? It's like a really, really, it was a fantastic school and they were very kind to me. I think I was a nightmare, Craig. I think I bullied people because I was laughed at and sniggered at. I didn't have like enough puffer jacket or trendy clothes, or I was a bit, I wasn't a crusty, but I certainly lived in my Joe Bloggs jeans and my Palladiums. Do you know what I mean? And I was, you know, look, I was listening to The Charlatans in my headphones and, you know, that was my kind of...
Well, you were certainly made to feel a certain way.
Yeah, so by some of the girls. And then I just felt so isolated. And if I mean, my way of dealing with it was really wrong, was if someone was horrible to me, I'd just go up and knock them out. And so every time I'd hit somebody or be... I mean, seriously, I was a nightmare for them. And I knew that. And I also knew that I was falling behind and I was embarrassed by that. And I think back then, obviously, I had a bit of an ego and it's like, I just didn't want that. And I used to be, I was still horrible, I think. And I think I was angry with the world and looking back at that point. And angry with the system. When you're a child of the state and you have no right or identity and they're locking the fridge and you can't access food and your bed smells of piss and you're sharing a room with a girl that's being exploited or abused, or there's so many elements that I was like, no wonder I wanted to be in a field dancing, listening to fucking Shades of Rhythm or whatever, you know, or Future Sound of London. No wonder those people were not, they weren't scary to me. The skinheads in Market Square were kinder to me. You know, the sweet, sweet Rasta men that I'd bump into in, you know, outside certain places, who would be, tell me, you know, little girl, go home, you know, because, you know, go on the streets tonight, you know, go home, guys.
Yeah.
They were kind, people were kinder to me out there than inside at home. Do you know what I mean? I was more looked after on the streets than I was at home, as opposed to, and I'm sure that's not the case for everybody. I think Nottingham was very small as well. So you get to know the different people that are sleeping rough or whether, you know, what was going on.
Well, it was the ultimate escape for you, wasn't it?
The big
escape to get away from it all.
A revolution. Yeah, it felt like a revolution though. Back then, you had the miners' strike. You'd had, you know, major recessions. You got the poll tax. You got all of these major political things that are happening in the country at that time, bubbling up. You know, we're so unhappy with the, you know, the Tories and. You know, I grew up, my dad, for all his faults, you know, was massively into the Socialist Workers' Party. You know, I lived in communes for a bit as a kid as well. And so I grew up really seeing injustice constantly, you know, and I suppose that the worst place for me was in a children's home, but it was also one of the best places for me because the things I've learned through that experience and the... you know, the toolkit it's given me to survive my life and to have a taste of what it's like on the other side and to be able to appreciate, you know, we talked about where I am now, my house or whatever.
Yeah.
I do pinch myself every day that I'm not dead or because of something that, you know, something unfortunate could have happened when I was a kid.
Sure.
Or, you know, environmental factors.
Or... you know, deeply, deeply traumatised.
I think I am. I suffer PTSD. I've got all sorts. But that's to do with abuse. That's not. I don't think that's so much to do with having a great time at raves for a few years. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Although I did used to say to people, because I used to say, wonder what E's are going to do to us later. Well, you know, taking E's now, it's all fantastic. What if we all get a bit weird? You know, because we didn't know what's going to happen to our brains in 30, 40 years.
Well, we'll soon find out.
Yeah, watch this space. Yeah.
do you ever think, looking back on it, Sam, and maybe now, that you were, because of all that, you were forced to grow up too quickly?
Yes and no. I think I was incredibly streetwise, but I always, and people that have known me for a very long time say I haven't really changed at all in lots of ways. And I think because of having a huge amount of faith, I was very, very religious as a child, very, very devout Catholic.
Right.
And I believe in magic and fairies and miracles, and I believe in just everything. I love every, you know, I'm a bit mystical like that in lots of ways, that I think you keep innocence, you keep hope and love, and I'm a bit of a hippie in that way, you know? So I think that, yes, I grew up, I was streetwise, but I could also feel a good vibe from somebody, people's auras, or I'd be like, oh, I like this person, or this person doesn't feel very good. I'm not good in this room right now. I think I need to leave. I'm not, you know, do you know what I mean? So
yeah, absolutely. But isn't it so lovely that you didn't just turn completely streetwise, that you kept some of the magic that we were talking about before, about a child playing. They just want to play.
Yeah.
And they don't know any different.
I thank my mum for that. I thank my mum a lot for that, because my dad was, you know, into his poetry and his communes and his The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And at times when we had no electricity or food or things like that, and he was single dad for a bit, he would just read to us for, you know, like, just, we had no telly, so he'd just, or when we had a bit of a, you know, lecky on the meter, he'd play a lot of, you know, he had this old wireless thing, so played really good music to us growing up. And my mum and my stepdad had a dodgy video shop, so in their house, so I watched a lot of films that I probably shouldn't have watched at the time. But they used to also record for me hours and hours of cartoons. So when I was allowed to go and visit my mum, which wasn't very often, but I had this, I was always in a fantasy land. Like, I remember one of the first things one of her favourite films was The Dark Crystal, the Jim Henson film.
Yeah.
And that became one of my favourite films when I was little. And it was the 80s, so we've got things like, you know, The Neverending Story or,
Labyrinth.
So you're, you know, watching Fraggle Rock, you know, you've got this, we were allowed a bit more innocence as kids then, I think, even though there was a huge amount of jeopardy going on the planet with the Cold War and America and Russia or what, you know, I think of the Falklands, you know, and my brother went, you know, he was in the military and was going off to Iraq, and there was a lot of shit going on in the 90s as well, you know, late 80s, early 90s. So, but I think we were allowed to be a bit more innocent then, in a, you know, and I, you know, but then tragedies happened, like Hillsborough, you know, and that, so you had bigger tragedies than yourself.
Yeah.
You're not feeling sorry for yourself growing up, because fucking hell, look what's happening. You know, you remember Live Aid wasn't that long ago in our brains, and Ethiopia and kids starving, and, you know, railway disasters or fucking, you know, the Falklands, and all this is still very real. We didn't have much on the news, and so it's, do you know what I mean?
And also, we're out playing. The news wasn't there all the time.
And everybody knew the local nonce was. So where we grew up, certain parts of Broxtowe where I lived, we knew which houses the nonces lived at.
Yeah.
So we just, nobody, you know, we knew the dodgy fucking men and nobody went near them.
Yeah.
And that sounds a really weird thing to throw into the conversation, but it meant everybody was playing out on the scooters, playing Kirby, you know, playing with different groups, because, and also we had loads of youth clubs and green spaces. This was before property, before Phil and Kirsty, before, you know, the greed of the kind of the person, what those people called, the property developer buying loads of houses and renting them back out to the council and all that. We didn't have that then. It just didn't exist, that level of greed. The greed was there, but not in those kind of ways. You've got a big council estate, everyone lives in a council house, nobody owns the council house, really. Not in Broxtowe, not back then. And, and everyone's playing out. And don't go near those two creepy bastards. And also, everyone looks out for everybody else. So, Sally's kid? Oh, you know, and it was that sense of community. The world has changed in ways that are so profoundly shocking that I think, I mean, I don't live on a council estate now. I don't know if kids are still allowed to play out in that way anymore because of, you know, communities not knowing each other in the same way, or I don't know.
It has changed. I was talking to somebody a few weeks ago and he was saying to me, you see this street here? It's one of the last sort of terrace streets in this area. But what it is, they've kept a community. Just these 20 houses, but they're a real community. Everybody talks to each other. Everybody looks out for each other. And I thought, crikey, I mean, remember when I lived in London, when I was in Camden? It's like, I didn't know the upstairs neighbour.
But people think you're weird, though, in London. When I was renting in London filming Harlots,
yeah,
I lived in a block of flats and I was friendly with all my neighbours. And
what area were you?
Kentish Town.
Right, okay.
Yeah,
so
and
just up the road.
Yeah, and I'd lived there years ago anyway, but we were renting this flat and it took people a while to realise I wasn't, I mean, maybe I'm a bit mad, but... you know, that I'm just this friendly lass.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And then,
yeah,
because when we were little, it was go and knock on, say, oh, go and borrow a cup of sugar and we'll give it back on payday or that. And
yeah.
I think that, and actually I had a lot of that when I lived in East London. It was beautiful living there in Spitalfields for me then.
You see, that seemed like a community.
Oh my gosh, everyone knew everyone. But
it was like we'd gone back in time. Whenever I was in that part,
yeah,
it was like it was really gone back to this old school but community
stuff. I think that is kind of whether we're working, you know, in the Spitalfields farm or, you know, like shopping at the same shop all the time, the local shop. When the big names are coming in and taking over the little local shops, it's hard then to build up, you know, rapport with people. It's really hard. And I think you have to get engaged in the community as well. You can't just live in your own little world, shut the door and draw the curtains. You have to actively say hello to people. And what happened to us when we were living there, we knew all the prostitutes that were on our doorstep because then it was pretty, you know, that's what it was. I was a newbie back then and there was people that had lived on the street for years and years, but, you know, but still they were welcoming and you get to know... the same passers-by and, oh, that's it, you know, and then, you know, as the years go by and Sandra Escalon, who obviously runs the Golden Heart, immediately, you know, I like a pint of Guinness, immediately welcomed me and my family and literally became like a mum. When I had my stroke, she came to visit me in hospital and bought me a pair of pyjamas, checking I was okay.
Yeah.
You know, and her children being so lovely to me and it's checking up, you know, and you know what I mean? It was amazing. And that, so I think it does still exist. People just have to invest in it. They have to put other people first. And maybe this COVID situation has made people more loving towards their neighbours and more, you know.
Well, that's what I was just going on to that because of the current state of the world and what we've all been thrust into, do you think we are going to invest more in community or do you think it's going to push more people away? Because it could go either way.
Yeah.
Because people are terrified to be sort of... I was with Hardy in the corner shop 4 or 5 weeks ago, maybe. Even before, we would always wear masks anyway. And I went to go and reach over and this other fella in the shop was kind of near me, but not that much. And he turned around and went, back off, and got really quite aggressive with me. And poor little, my son's with me. Me and him are wearing masks, me and Hardy. He wasn't wearing a mask and I went, I'm hardly near you. And plus, you're not even wearing a mask.
Yeah.
We're wearing masks for you. Not for us, it's for you.
Yeah.
And you're being aggressive with me. But it really upset little Hardy.
I'm not surprised.
Because it's like, oh, are we going to come together and look out for each other? Or are we going to war? Are we going to fight? Is it going to turn very aggressive because people are scared and nervous? Mm. I just don't know. I see good and bad things all the time.
I don't really have an answer to that other than...
I tell you what it is
for me is I have to believe that on a global level that we will connect, we will start to connect. The internet's done some pretty awful things, has opened up some pretty awful Pandora's boxes, but it's also enabled us to really connect with communities, whether it's learning a little bit more about Black Lives Matter, protests and also the injustice, the social injustice in the United States or in Turkey or, you know, it's stuff that happens in the UK, you know, like it's hard to, you have to be very careful though with social media, what you believe and what you don't believe and all of that. But at the same time, I think that it will bring us together. It cannot. And look what happened in the 20s after, you know, the Spanish flu. Everyone loved everybody. It was like this, it was almost like a summer of love vibe.
Yeah.
And I have to have hope that that will happen. But I'm not blind to the fact that human instinct is often, I'm the king of the castle and you're the dirty rascal. And I'm all right, Jack. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think it's who your leader is and what the message is about. And it's like when we're on a job, if we, you know, you're on an unhappy job, you go, oh, it comes from the top. Let's just see what's going on, you know, with the powers that be. And it filters down. Yeah. So I think that, you know, I think there's hope, huge hope.
But I agree with you. I think we've got to have hope and we've got to feel some sort of positivity about it. Because if we go the other way, that's going to send us under. It'd send me under.
Yeah.
If I just thought doom and gloom and full of negativity.
But we've got an election coming up in America in November. And we have a country that is so phenomenally powerful on the global stage that needs to sort its shit out. We need to sort our shit out. I think change is coming. I do. But sometimes things have to get really bad before they can get better. That's what I just tell myself.
Yeah, well,
you know,
that's true.
We have to have some metamorphosis. We have to have a real kind of realization. And, you know, even just thinking back to Brexit, you know, and I was devastated when Labour didn't get in. And I was absolutely shocked at the Conservative landslide.
Yeah.
And I had to do some real kind of soul searching in regards to why didn't Labour get in? What have they done that's so bad that people don't understand that they don't give a flying fuck about them, as in the Tories?
Mm.
Why don't they get that? Why don't these these Labour heartlands get that? And, you know, obviously it seemed to be a Jeremy Corbyn issue or anti-Semitic, you know, issue and all of that. But people had had enough as well. At the end of the day, people just want jobs and they want good schools and they want nice roads and they want, you know, and they'd had enough. So, yeah, I've got a lot of kind of thinking to be done in regards to, because I was living in America. I love America. I've spent most of my career living and working there, as you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, I mean, you know, you look at CNN or whatever, there's messed up things all over. But, you know, looking at, sadly, an eight-year-old boy in Florida was arrested in school. And, you know, they're arresting children and putting them in handcuffs and how they, you know, this kind of school-to-prison thread. And, you know, it's still legal in 27 states for a white Christian 60-year-old man to marry a 12-year-old girl. And, you know, we still have a long, long way to go if one of the most powerful, you know, countries on the planet is still so far behind.
Well, it's like, as you said before, it starts from the top and it trickles down.
Yeah. It's just nuts, isn't it?
Yeah. Sam, when did the raving kind of stop? And because we haven't even spoken about getting into acting yet. I mean, we've spoken a little bits of influences of reading and poetry and all that. I'm just wondering when that kind of came into your life or if it was bubbling under there prior.
I was at school, at junior school, and we did Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat. Mm. And I auditioned for Joseph and didn't get it. This brilliant girl called Gemma Rollo got it, and she is brilliant, by the way. And I was like, okay, Gemma got it. But I knew that she had, like, proper dancing lessons and all that. And I was a bit jealous, really. She was awesome. I got the part of the Pharaoh. And also, you've got to remember, I was the kid that would be, if someone was being bullied, I'd go up to that bully in the playground and headbutt them like a nutter, like an absolute nutter. So I was always getting suspended. I went to so many junior schools, it was hilarious. So I had this confidence about me that was like to do with when things were wrong, sticking up for people.
Injustices.
Totally. Yeah. And I could read aloud in class, looking back. it wasn't so much I was like a Bonnie Langford type child, but I didn't give a fuck, if that makes sense. Like, I just wasn't shy. Yeah. Like, whatever, I'll do it, yeah, whatever. And I, anyway, so there was this really, really lovely teacher at school called Mr. Thompson, and he said to me, you seem to be really good at drama. I don't know what drama was, do you know what I mean? He said, I think you should do some drama. And he wrote down on a piece of paper for me, Central Junior TV Workshop. And anyway, I can't remember what happened to that piece of paper, but I moved, of course, and then eventually I found myself in a children's home a few years later. And and Mr. Thompson had also been at my other school, because that's what Nottingham's like. So he'd known me with another set of foster parents, where I used to put plays on. I used to write plays, put them on in the school hall, on the stage with all my mates.
Right.
You know, if I could get a chance at playing Chopsticks, I would, do you know what I mean? On the piano, like, I just loved a stage. And just, yeah, it was just, anyway, I loved it. And so anyway, there we go. I'm there now in this children's home. And I had been doing gymnastics, weirdly, this is another one, for years. And I was in a proper, like, I was doing proper gymnastics, not like just a bit of roly-poly, getting your bagger awards. Like, I was proper in a gymnastics club, Rushcliffe Gym Club. And I was in a car accident and I broke my knee and my shoulder and my tummy, really messed. I was in a bad way anyway. Got hit on a zebra crossing, would you believe it? And really? Oh, mega horrible accident, yeah.
Fuck.
And so I couldn't do gymnastics anymore. And I was like there with, you know, my plaster cast had come off and I was back in, you know, I was in this children's home. And they knew I was a bright kid, you know, I wasn't there sniffing glue or taking gas or, you know, they could sense, you know, they could have a conversation with me. I was a bright kid. Mm. There were other bright kids there, but that just been as fortunate to have the foster parents I'd had or whatever. Do you know what I mean? And my dad was bright as well. So, you know,
your real dad.
And my stepdad, phenomenally intelligent man. I said, oh, I remembered, you know, really wanting to do this drama thing anyway. And I'd been watching television programmes, as you do as a kid, and I just thought the acting was really rubbish and I thought the writing was really rubbish for children. You know, when grown-ups write for children, they're like, oh, well, go on then, or whatever. And I was like, we don't even speak like that.
It's not how children speak.
Yeah, and I think I wrote some kind of letter along with my key worker, who had a lovely key worker in that home called Kathleen Lindsay. She was amazing. So kind to me. I think she wrote off or something. Anyway, I got an application form and I wrote a letter, stuck my picture on it. And then I moved again to another foster family. And I went for an audition, but I got a recall, but I didn't know. And so I missed the recall. And then back in the home
again. Why didn't you know?
Because the foster parents didn't tell me that I'd got a recall. Right. They didn't give me my post or whatever. And as a child, I would have only had, that would have been what it was. Do you know what I mean? That lovely envelope with the Central TV logo on it, that the world with the colours. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So exciting when you got one of those letters. Anyway, so eventually the children's home sorted it out that I could get to one of these auditions to see if I could get in the group. And I got in the group. So I was very young when I started workshop. And I
How old?
11 or 12, it was 11 or 12 or something. It was young. Wow, right, my dates were all over the place. You have to bear with me. And and basically there was this thing, Ian Smith, who I love and still a very, very dear friend to me, was doing this, what's called improvisation. And we were in a circle. I don't know what that was. And so at the audition, he has to whisper in everyone's ear, like, you know, like, Vanula's stolen your hamster, you know, off you go, like, you know, a bit, not quite Legs Akimbo from League of Gentlemen, but do you know what I mean? It wasn't, it wasn't far off that.
Not a world away.
Yeah. And I remember this girl, I think I beat her up, I attacked her, and Ian was like, whoa, and I was like, you told me she fucking nicked my hamster, do you know what I mean? And that's what I do if, like, someone nicked my hamster. Anyway, so I got in the group through being an absolute nutter, and that changed my life. So wherever I was, whether I was sleeping on the streets or with different foster parents, I still tried to get to workshop. You know, because people always want to help somebody like me when I was a kid. There's always to kind people going, right, we're going to sort you out. Come on, put your socks up. You can do this. Because I had potential, I suppose. So when did it all stop? It stopped at around the age of, I'd say, 14 and a half, 15.
Right.
I got into a lot of serious trouble with the police. And that changed my life, being in an adult cell for 3 days, solitary confinement for 3 days, because that's what they did with kids back then. They still do. And that was a turning point to go. It was a big wake-up call, like you can't do this anymore. And I had a dream, actually. I had this really weird dream that I was on this roller coaster, and I fell out of off the roller coaster, and Sam in the dream went, listen to your American accent, Sam. And I was talking American, I was speaking an American accent. And then I floated down through all these stars in the sky, and I could hold them and I could touch them. And then I landed on a street like in Mapley Park, like Nottingham Street, with all these huge old trees and beautiful big Victorian houses. And it was all the mist was kind of halfway up, and I saw a TV and a remote control on the floor. And I walked up and I picked this remote control up, and I couldn't quite work the channels out, but I was trying to change the channels on the telly. And then I turned, and then I walked into this huge kind of Victorian Gothic Nottingham kind of house. And it was really tired and old, with broken windows and badly painted. And then I was walking up the stairs, and then I went into this bathroom again that was really badly painted. And I looked in the mirror, and it was me, and then there was another me, and the other me I didn't quite recognise. And then I woke up. Anyway, I had this dream a few times, reoccurring dream.
Really?
Oh, yeah, and I wrote it down. Because I've always kept diaries. Dream. Yeah, and I've wrote it all down, wrote it down years ago, and I've had it a few times. And I started looking into, like, dream analysis books and things like that. And I was all into, like, Linda Goodman's, sun signs and love signs and things that, I liked a bit of aromatherapy as well, all of that. And I felt that I'd had a significant dream, and it was a what's called, like a main dream in your life that is a teaching dream. And I thought, if I carry on the roller coaster where I am, I'm going to be fucked. I need to reclaim my life, and the idea of the television being able to change the channels, I can do that. And in dreams, houses are meant to represent yourself. So they might have all been broken, but there was I can get inside myself and I can fix this. I can change everything. I can fix this house up. I can make it better. I can get to the heart of myself. And it took a huge amount of courage to stop hanging out with the mates I was hanging out with and just not see all those people anymore. And these are back in the day when you don't got computers or phones or...
No. But especially at such a young age where you're going, right, I'm going to take control.
I got sent to what's called a children's home that was like a secure unit, the bars and things like that. And it was hot, and it was a really horrible time because I was always moving to different children's homes anyway, where there was horrible abuse happening. And I was running away and staying in these kind of weird squats and things like that. And I just knew that I had to, that I couldn't celebrate it anymore. I couldn't go out and celebrate in the same way anymore because when you're going back to what I was going back to, that wasn't good. And I knew that in order to change the system, I had to work with the system. So I had to toe the line. I had to do whatever they fucking told me to do, keep smiling, gritted teeth in order to get out. And right. I eventually got this place, they call it an independence unit, but it's basically a homeless hostel for young people who have got nowhere else to go. Right. And that is meant to be a stepping stone before you get your first flat. And so, yeah, and also Ian Smith stayed in my life. So even though I was kicked out of workshop for being, unreliable, late, letting people down, because that's what happens when you're inconsistent with all of that, obviously wasn't at school, I was not a good member of the community at the workshop at that time. So I was not there. I was, kicked out. And then Ian let me back in. Right. I got in touch with him. I'd been writing a lot of poetry, and he used to be an English teacher. So I'd asked him to read all my poetry, and I'd tried to write a play. And then he brought me back to the workshop, and then we collectively devised the play that I'd been trying to write, called Twok, which was Taken Without Owner's Consent.
Yeah.
And so that was the first kind of attempt at any kind of, a bit like with The Unloved, like getting behind the scenes a bit. And I played a couple of parts in it, but it was life-changing.
It's funny because we were talking about roots before, and it sounds like finally with the workshop they were kind of like the roots that you were needing for all this time.
So, well, I think Ian believed in me, but I mean, I remember telling social workers, because you have so many at different times, like, I want to go to London, I want to become an actor and go to London, I want to go to drama school. And they were like, well, you know, they only give out a few performing arts grants in Nottingham a year at that time, and you're competing with dancers, musicians. You think you're going to get a grant to go to drama school in London? And by the way, Sam, you need GCSEs. So I went back to college to try and get some GCSEs, and they let me in college early because I wasn't allowed at any comprehensive school. I was barred from all the schools. No schools would let me in.
Because of your behaviour in the past?
Yeah, because of my criminal record and things like that.
Right.
And so they really kindly let me into Clarendon College to try and do... They let me do a BTEC in drama. And I had a great education welfare officer who was trying to just do something with me because she could see I'd got potential. So from 14, I started going to college.
What happened at the end of college?
I wasn't consistent with it because I couldn't afford stuff at college. I couldn't get bus fare sometimes, or I didn't get sleep because of where I was living. And, you know, if there was a riot in the home, you're not going to be able to get up in the morning and get two buses to college. Or so I didn't stay at college. But then again, Ian believed in me, and when I was allowed back into the workshop, he started giving me train fare to go to London for auditions, and that's when I got peak practice, and that's when I got Cracker.
You just started turning up at these auditions. But oh no, because he was probably connected with the workshop.
Yeah, it was Ian.
Yeah
because I'd done a bit. You know, he did this thing where he'd taken us all on a minibus to London, and he'd hired a room at the Groucho Club. And it was a showcase for Nottingham talent to see if we could get agents. And
right.
I got an agent as well, but I was 16 at that point for that, and living in the homeless hostel. And so, yeah, through Ian and a really, really amazing agent called Michael Emptage, who worked at a company with Sharon Hamper, they believed in me and started sending me off to these auditions. And it sounds really like, I don't know, like I'm full of myself, but I literally got every part I went up for a couple of weeks. It was all a bit weird. And then I suddenly went back to my little homeless hostel room and was with my best friends and went, I think I'm going to move to London. And turned up in London because I got a play at the Royal Court and I had nowhere to live. I'd got a name of someone on a piece of paper that a really dear friend of mine knew someone in London and said, this is when you go, this is just phone this person. She might have a room. And looking back, the social services knew that I wanted to go to London. They could have got me a flat, a council flat or something, you know, but they didn't. So again, I get to London. I'm just, do you know what I mean? A bit sleeping at St. Pancras station wasn't a good idea.
God. No.
Because if I missed the last train, or if I, you know, wandering around or whatever, before I knew anyone in London and you're going off to auditions, do you get what I mean? You're not.
Yeah.
You know, it was a funny old time.
Did you start to settle though? Did you feel that London was a place? Because it's so funny at the start, you know, we were talking about Nottingham and the sense of roots and how proud people there are from and you are, but you love London.
I fell in love with London immediately. I thought it was amazing because I'd watched an American Werewolf in London, and this was my first time in London. I was like, oh my God, it's like the movies. My agent was on Great Queen Street, which is, you know, Covent Garden, and it literally was like Dick Whittington. The streets were paved with gold, but happiness, like the smell of Soho, the people, oh my, I thought it was, I was like, oh, I might be able to get to the fridge in Brixton. Because when I used to listen to Rave FM, they always used to talk about the fridge in Brixton. And I was like, oh, and all these things I can do. And I'll go to the Roxy or, you know, or, you know, there was, I don't know, like, you know, things travel. Like, even like when friends of mine from the workshop would go to London for the day, they'd come back with the best shoes from Shelley's. Because we only, yeah, we had a Specto in Nottingham that's still there, by the way, an amazing shoe shop. And we got Paul Smith, remember? He's from Nottingham in the Paul Smith shop. Yeah. And we had really, you know, and everyone, we liked our, you know, our Ralph Lauren, and we liked our Stone Island. You know, we got our thing. And I think
the clubber.
Nottingham people really know how to dress, I have to say that.
Yeah.
But here you are in London again. Oh, there's the London shops. Do you know what I mean? And
yeah.
And I'd stopped shoplifting at that point. So I wasn't going to steal anything.
It's a good job, really.
But I did fall in love with London. But London gave me the theatre, actually. Like, I'd never done a proper play. I'd done plays down at workshop. But 16, getting a play at the Royal Court was just amazing. Yeah. And Ian Rickson, again, took a chance on me. And I'm grateful, you know, to him for that. And it's where I first met Jonathan Harvey, who's a really good friend of mine. And, you know, I was able to see, you know, and I, you know, James Hooton, a friend of mine, had done a play at the Bush, and I'd gone to see that as well. And I just felt like there was this magic in the air, and I felt part of that magic. I'm forever grateful, you know, forever grateful. And forever grateful to a woman called Dee, who's sadly not here anymore. But she, again, I imagine this kid, imagine today, like, your doorbell rings, and there's someone going, "You're all right."
You go, "Hello, you got a room."
She's like, "Hello." And you're like, "Yeah, my name's Sam. Caroline, has Caroline been in touch? She said I was to say come by." And she's like, "No, but you all right?" You know, she let me up these. I remember Peabody Buildings in Covent Garden. You know, so up I go up all the stairs, and I get to the top, and this amazing woman with this long black hair and tattoos everywhere. She worked at Abbey Road. She was a sound engineer at Abbey Road. She was like, "Come in," and we just sat talking till like 3-4 in the morning. Just, she was, I was just fortunate to meet the best people at the right time. She was like, she's like, "You can stay. Yeah, you can stay." And I was like, "Oh my God." So I was in her spare room, and then I went off, you know what I mean? So I did when I was doing my play at the Royal Court, I stayed at Dee and Watty's, who became my friends. And I was just so fucking lucky, you know, even like meeting Kathy Burke on one of my first jobs, big jobs. And, you know, having those strong, intelligent, opinionated, you know, forward-thinking, kind women in my life at such a young age. And I have to say, the same happened to me. I moved to New York when I was 19, and that happened to me there. I just seemed to meet the certain people at the right time that opened up doors to me and opportunities to me. So,
Do you think it is still all about timing and luck?
Yes. It's got to be a bit of that going on in the world all the time. Like, if I didn't cross the street at that time, would I have been hit by that car or this or that?
Yeah.
Because we're all living our lives, and we have it. The amount of times you must have been into town and you go, you bump into somebody, you go, "Oh my God." And you know yourself that you're running late or you shouldn't have been there at that time. But if you hadn't and you see that person and it's made your day, or it's made you think about something differently, or you're like, "Oh my," or we all get it when we're thinking about someone, the bloody ringers, or I do believe in things like that. But I do believe we have the power deep, deep down to affect and manifest positive changes in our life. Because depression is a real thing, oppression is a real thing, societal fuckery is a real thing. But if you genuinely inside wake up in the morning, and I'm not trying to preach about God here, but I do believe in God. I believe in a higher power. I thank the Lord for every day I'm alive and my children are safe and well. And that might not always be the case. You know, life is a fucking tough one, you know. But I think that attitude and that kind of, you know, que sera, sera. And I think when you've been so low and everything's been so fucking shit as a kid, what the fuck can happen? What can happen? Sorry about my language today, but what can happen? Nothing can touch you. And it's Psalms, I don't know, is it Psalms? Something, is it like Psalms 27, I think, or 26. The Lord is my light, for whom shall I fear? You know, and then they talk about, you know, mine enemies came and tried to get my flesh, but the Lord was, you know, like, you and as a kid, I'd be like, all these people that harmed me, you could do what the fuck you like to me, but you're not going to get to my brain. You cannot get my soul. So all everything else from that point, if I didn't get a part, I didn't get it. And I think for a lot of actors, that's a real, real struggle. Rejection.
Yeah.
And ego and all of that. And I was like, fuck it. I'm just happy to play Mandy the car thief with two lines because I'm earning more. My 50 quid is more than I was getting, you know, living where I was before. And that has never, ever left me. And in,
you still feel that now?
Yes, absolutely. I'll be doing a scene at work and it's not pleasant. I might have issues with it. And I'll be like, hold on a minute. This is, well, that's paying for the shower. This is paying for the shower.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
It sounds really shallow, but I'm like, no, we need a new shower. It's paying for the shower. Craig, I'm going to shut my windows because it's getting dark and I was eaten alive last night by a mosquito. So I'm going to shut my windows.
Get it shut. One sec.
Samantha Morton is going to the lace curtains and she's shutting the door. No, she's shutting the window.
I've got proper nets on that one, so that one's all right. And it's so hot that I would like the windows open, actually, but, you know.
One word, citronella.
I know, I need a citronella candle, I do. Harry hates the smell. I don't mind the smell. He hates the smell. I can hardly have lavender oil in the car. I put lavender oil on pine cones because we've got dogs, yeah. And I hate this. You know, dogs can get quite smelly and horrible.
Mm.
So if I
wet dog.
Oh, my God. So put in a bit of lavender oil or, you know, sandalwood oil on a pine cone or a bunch of acorns and just dropping them in the bottom of the footwell. And Harry, when he had his, when I first met him, he had a really nice car. And he'd be like, he didn't know I'd hidden all these pine cones and acorns in his car. he was like, why does my car stink like old ladies? It's fucking horrible. And I'd be like, I didn't say anything for ages, and then I was like, no, it's me, sorry.
Sam, we're talking before about, you know, moving around from school to school and different children's homes. There was constant sort of that kind of life. And even now, you still do that with job to job when you go around the world, but you pick up the family and they're never not with you, are they?
Yes,
pretty much.
I think,
like, if you're going to America for a long
we go together.
Time, like,
yeah, I did one job in America by myself, and it was awful because we just thought, oh, we'll give it a go, and it didn't work at all. We tried, and it didn't work for not only for me, for them, it was horrible. So yeah. We're very close family, but I think that. The jobs changed, you know, like it used to be that you'd do movies and the movies didn't take that long. And my part wasn't always like the biggest part. So your days are like, okay, so it's they're shooting for 12 weeks, but you're filming from, you know, the 8th to the 21st. And then you've got a week off and then you've got 2 days here or whatever. And so your family doesn't always travel with you, but I made all those things work. And then films are kind of drying up because they're just not being made anymore in the way that they used to be made. And television kicks in. So the first telly thing like that was the Las Panthers, where as a family, we went to Montenegro and Serbia and Marseille and London. And that was the first time we ever really kind of went, come on, off we all go. Mm. And that was really fun and interesting and Edie must have only been about, well, Teddy was a baby. Teddy must have been about a year and Edie was six or something. So, you know, like.
Oh, my God.
It's an adventure. Edie learned Serbian and she knew the, you know, Cyrillic alphabet because we had we needed to get some help. So we had this amazing nanny, a Serbian nanny, who spoke fluent English because had worked in England for years, but was taught Edie Serbian, and that's and she remembers so much about that time, and you know, and I learned a huge amount on that job, so it is amazing. But I think now Edie's going to start her. She's 12 now.
Yeah.
And that can't happen anymore. And I don't think that's right and fair to do that to a child at that age when they need their friends and their consistency. So I don't know. I mean, that's why The Walking Dead was a bit of a, like, okay, do we do this as a family? Do we move to the States? Like, properly? And we sat and we talked about it, and Edie was young enough whereby she could still do that. And so we did it. And it was...
And it worked.
It wasn't easy because of the, you know, being in Georgia. And I think had we been filming in LA or New York, it might have been a lot easier. But I don't drive, so we were living quite, you know, not rurally, but in a beautiful, beautiful small town. But the school system there is quite complex because in Georgia it's still legal to paddle a child. So corporal punishment still happens to children as young as 4.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I didn't want to stay in Atlanta. I love Atlanta, but I couldn't live in Atlanta because of, again, I didn't drive. And when you're doing television in America, you have to drive yourself to work. There's no such thing as unit drivers.
Mm.
You probably knew that. I didn't know that. And so,
I know, but this is for the other people listening to the podcast.
In England, you are treated like an idiot, a baby on film sets.
Yeah.
They drive you in. And it's because they work you really long hours, to be fair, as well. They drive you in and they drive you home. Or you share a car with a group of other people. Woody Allen gave us a minibus. Everyone's on a minibus. But in television in America, you have to drive yourself. And because I don't drive, I was like, well, I can't be in Atlanta because I'm not going to have to get an Uber to work every day. That's half my wages on just getting to work.
Yeah, exactly.
You think about it for all that time for the 7 or 8 months we're filming. So we stayed near to where I was filming, which was great. But it meant that the school choices were pretty, pretty crazy in regards to this corporal punishment thing.
Yeah.
So we decided to homeschool. And there's a huge homeschooling community, you know, out there, America. It's very, very common because people have all sorts of issues with the education system out there. So, yeah.
But I know a few friends of mine that homeschool in the Northwest, and there is a huge community once you sort of cast the net out.
Yeah.
It's all there, and they all know each other, and they all get together.
Yeah, exactly. You meet up at, you know, recreation grounds and do stuff together. And, yeah, and sometimes you even go and see the same teacher together. So, like, in Georgia, there was a few kids that went to this certain science teacher, and, you know, so you have someone facilitate all the different lessons. You're not just, you know, as a parent, you're not just struggling with that alone.
It's like we were talking about before about, you know, a sense of community. That in itself is another community, the homeschooling community, and they all sort of get together.
Yeah.
Sam, have you ever thought about not acting?
Yes.
And knocking it all on the head. Not in a slightly sort of whimsical way, in a deadly serious way.
Yeah.
If that's possible.
Yeah, I've had a couple of, 3 times. So the first time was after my stroke. And I was...
Can we just let the listeners know? Because obviously I know what happened.
Yeah.
But if you just sort of let us in prior to the stroke.
A ceiling fell on my head. And
don't laugh. I'm not laughing.
No, it is. It's fine to laugh. Only me.
I'm not laughing. I've never laughed.
I was born on Friday the 13th. I get hit by a car on a zebra crossing. Do you know what I mean? It's like, fucking, if a bird's going to shit, it's going to shit on my head kind of thing. A ceiling fell on my head. And it was a new ceiling, but it would have been made with not enough horsehair. You know, it was a lime plaster vibe and all that. And it cut my vertebral artery. And I was very lucky because I was able to be diagnosed very quickly. So I made a full recovery from my stroke. But I was just petrified. I think the first job I did going after the stroke was synecdoche. And I got pregnant as well. So I just recovered from the stroke, came out of hospital, went to New York, got pregnant, was filming with, you know, Phil Seymour Hoffman, you know, the Charlie Kaufman film.
Yeah.
And I found it all kind of overwhelming, I think. I think it's been pregnant as well. And I remember then thinking, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And then recently I've been thinking, I mean, I love directing, you see, as you know, we worked together on my first film, and that is something that I'm really hungry to get back behind the camera again. I've done a few music videos and an arty film and things like that, but I think that that's something that I really want to explore.
But and I can say this because you're my friend, it seems as natural a place for you behind the camera as it does in front. From looking at it from the outside,
thank you
on the floor. Do you know what I mean? It was very.
I felt very comfortable. I felt like I'd been there all my life. I did, and I
yeah,
think, and
that's exactly
that
what it's like.
And I think
exactly.
So yeah, I have gone. Oh, and it is mainly to do with work life balance and health, as opposed to hating acting or hating the industry because I now more than ever love it. More than ever, you know, with what's happened with the theatre and COVID and our industry and COVID. So, yeah.
Can you see recovery in the near future? Or do you think it's going to take a long time for our industry to get back on from its knees? Because it is. I feel it's on its knees at the moment. And I know there's a lot of people that are very, very worried.
I don't see how regional theatres that were already struggling with council cutbacks... I don't see at the moment how, unless local government deems it an essential thing like your GP or your dentist, how those places will survive at the moment. Because at the end of the day, people have to at least, you know, cover their costs. And at the moment, that isn't a possibility. Who knows what the future holds? But I think at the moment it seems pretty grim. And I think that the bigger productions, at the moment, they're getting back to work. They're testing everybody a lot. Mm. But those tests are very expensive. So if you want to make a low-budget film right now and you're testing the whole crew, I mean, SAG have really strict rules about it, which is brilliant in America, the SAG-AFTRA Union. And I love what they're doing, and they're really looking after their members. But at the same time here, I haven't had an email from Equity, I don't know if you have, about... what our rights are on set and things like that. So I think it's a bit flaky, no? It's a bit like the Wild West. People are, obviously the insurance companies are going to have to be involved, but I don't think it's just a case of mass testing. I think it's a case of, I mean, where are you going to go? If somebody gets coronavirus on a film set because of someone else's negligence and dies, are their family going to sue? I mean, it's a really serious thing. So,
and we all know what a tight ship it is on a set, and everybody's together. And look at the crew.
Yeah, but if you get tired, you might make a little mishap and touch something you shouldn't have touched and scratch your face, or you know, it's not like we can wear full PPE and have a chat.
Which is why I've got to keep carrying on these conversations because I don't know when I'm going to get back in front of a camera.
But it's great that you've got this. And what I think is really brilliant is that you do this anyway, but that to have a purpose, to have something, and you're amazing at this and talking to people and being interested and asking questions. And it's hard for me not to bat it back at you and go, what do you think? And like, we're in the pub having a chat.
No, but you know, you can do that. But that's why I started this, because I want to turn the spotlight on somebody else and have the focus purely on them. Because as I feel like I'm always repeating this, but I was saying this last night to someone, it's very rare that you sit down with either a friend or someone that you don't know and it's make it all about them. And that's
unless
all,
it's therapy.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
which this kind of is.
Or you're going to a fortune teller.
Yes, if you pop into Blackpool to go and see Gypsy Rose Lee, she'll be there for you.
Yeah.
Although not anymore, they're all closed down at the moment.
Oh, that's too upsetting.
Well, social distancing. What we need is a social distancing fortune teller, Sam. That's what we need.
That's my next job. I'll get me candles out and start that.
I think it's perfect. Samantha Morton, I am so pleased that we've finally been able to sit down and do this, because I know we've been nattering and talking about you coming on this for fucking 3 years.
It's true.
But I'm really thrilled. It's been an absolute pleasure. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, was that it?
Yeah.
That was a long time. But it went really quickly, and we didn't really talk about acting, which was great.
No, I know, because when I have actors on, I've always, it's not a rule, but I'd never like to steer the conversation into what was such and such like, because because part of our job at the end is all the press, and it's like, those questions about that film or that actor or this director. Yeah, yeah. It's like, I want it to be a much more human aspect. I want it to be about the person.
Well, thank you. It was great.
And another episode is done. What an absolute belter of an episode. I love chatting with Sam. So great. I really hope you enjoyed it. So thank you so much for downloading and subscribing. You know where we are. We're on all the social medias at Two Shot Pod. Send us a message. You can send us an email if you like. It's twoshotpod@gmail.com. And yeah, you take care. And we'll definitely see you next week for episode 130. I am just setting up to record with somebody who is currently residing in Los Angeles. I'll leave that one with you. As if you're going to work it out from that. Such a crap clue. Anyway, you take care of yourself until next week, okay? And we'll see you bright and early next Thursday. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Take it easy. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.